Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michelson. We've got a great panel of some of the smartest people I know. We've got another presidential candidate ahead. But we begin this week with Governor Gavin Newsom. He is pushing a health care plan that is a bit controversial. Here's what he wants to do. He wants to bring back the individual mandate that requires you to buy health insurance. He says that's going to bring a lot of extra money. With some of that extra money, he's going to be able to provide health care to undocumented kids under 26. He also wants to increase subsidies for everybody. He says your premiums are going to go down if this happens. He's torn the state trying to pitch this plan. It's not clear if the state legislature is going to back this plan, but as part of his pitch, he wanted to talk to us. So here is my conversation with Governor Gavin Newsom. Joining us now from Sacramento is the governor of California, Governor Gavin Newsom. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
Good to be with you.
Governor, you've admitted that at this point, you're sort of in a back and forth with the legislature. You may not get everything you want. There's some negotiating going on. What is the number one priority, the most important thing that you want to get when it comes to health care?
Well, we got to stabilize our insurance market. The vandalism that was done by the Trump administration with the elimination of the individual mandate has increased your premiums, increased the premiums of every single person watching this program. I want to stabilize the market, increase the risk pool by diversifying the risk pool, ultimately stabilizing the need to increase premiums. We do that by establishing a statewide framework. And in doing so, it will generate $330 million that will allow us to expand subsidies to working families, to the middle class, for families earning up to $150,000 with an additional $100 a month subsidy to offset their current costs of health care.
One of the most controversial impacts is this issue of taxpayers paying for the health care of undocumented young adults. Why should California taxpayers pay for the health care of undocumented people when we can barely afford to pay for the health care of our own citizens?
Well, they're already doing it. They're paying for it universally. And it's called sick care at every emergency room in the state of California. The perversity of that, I think the question should be, why do we want to spend so much on the back end when we can spend a lot less on the front end? Universal health care means universal health care for everybody, stabilizing the population in terms of their risk, increasing, again, a risk pool, which ultimately brings down the cost of premiums for everybody. But I got to remind folks, your premiums, what you're paying today, your employer-based health insurance, what you're getting through Medi-Cal or even Medicare, already has in there, fixed in that cost, every month you pay, the cost of providing acute care, regardless of individuals' immigration status. And so, for me, it's just common sense. It's the right thing to do morally and ethically, but it's also a fiscally thoughtful thing to do. And I encourage other states and other governors to join California's lead.
So the Trump administration got rid of the individual mandate. This brings it back here in California. But the same basic argument remains from back during Obamacare. If I don't want to buy health insurance, why should the government force me to do it?
Well, why should we pay more in our premiums? Because you are not investing in broadening the societal risk pool. The fact is, our premiums went up last year because of Donald Trump. It was a massive tax increase in this country, felt by every Californian that has health insurance. We estimate of the 9% that we had increased in our premium through our California Health Exchange, 5% of that came because of the elimination of the individual mandate. We believe that we have the capacity to lower premiums, increase coverage, and then provide more subsidies for those struggling to make ends meet if everyone participates. By the way, that's not Obama's idea. That was the idea of a Republican think tank, ultimately manifested through a Republican governor in Massachusetts that advanced this effort. It used to be universally accepted across the political aisle. Now, of course, the Trump administration is not just trying to eliminate the mandate and increase your premiums. They're trying to eliminate every other protection that was part of the ACA that impacts every single person watching.
Of course, that Republican governor was Mitt Romney. Let's talk for a moment about reproductive rights, which is such an important issue to you, such an important issue when it comes to health care. This month, Alabama and Georgia, both in the news, are poised to impose some of the strictest abortion laws in the entire country. Some have suggested that Hollywood should pull out of Georgia. Alyssa Milano suggesting maybe there should be a sex strike. How do you think
that Californians, and perhaps the state itself, how should California as a state respond to this?
I think these are unconstitutional laws, not unique, by the way, to Georgia, not unique to Alabama. We've seen this in Iowa, Mississippi, Kentucky. We've seen it in North Dakota. Luckily, the courts have intervened in a number of those states. Ultimately, courts will intervene in the Alabama and Georgia instances. But California can now invite back production into the state. We need to recognize we need to do more to support that production beyond tax credits. And I encourage these boycotts of sorts to the extent that it ultimately will bring back an industry that we birthed here in our state.
But do you think that the state itself should pull some deals from Georgia? We've seen things like that in the past. Should we pull deals from Alabama? Should there be a statewide response?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's up to individuals to the extent that we've seen this in the past with LGBTQ issues, individual companies. I remember at a time when Mike Pence was governor of his state in Indiana, one of the largest companies in California, Salesforce, said we're no longer going to do business in that state. That had more impact than state travel bans. In the past, we've had state travel bans, meaning we won't use taxpayer dollars to subsidize conferences in those states. So individuals, companies, cities have done the same. The state, to the extent our AG has advanced similar travel bans. I think all of that should be in the mix. Good people can disagree. Our values are well established here in California as a state that prides itself on standing up for reproductive rights and women's right to choose. I thought it rather remarkable and disgraceful, not surprising. You had 25 white males in that Alabama legislature determining the fate of women's rights in this country and in their state, potentially impacting the country if this goes to the Supreme Court and we see a reversal of Roe v. Wade. So we all have to stand up. We all have to assert ourselves. And I'm proud to be in California where we have the backs of women and we're going to protect their reproductive rights.
All right. Well, we're running out of time, but we like to have a little bit of fun on this show. So quickly, for our friends in San Francisco watching on KTVU in Oakland, I want a prediction for what happens next for the Warriors, and if they make it to the finals, how many games?
Well, I mean, I can't imagine it's more than six, but it's likely five. But look, it is good to see the Warriors of old, even without Durant. We love Durant, but it's good to see the Warriors of old. I hope this continues. Forgive me, Laker fans.
And, of course, you may see the Warriors without Durant next year, too. Real quickly, who wins Game of Thrones?
Oh, geez, I'm not going to go there. I can't get into Game of Thrones. I can't. I could talk about the final episode of Veep, which is something it's going to take me a couple years to work through as I go back to reruns. I'm going to miss it.
And then you could potentially watch some things happening in real life and get some of that satire happening as well.
Funny. That's
all
true.
Right.
Our thanks to Governor Gavin Newsom, and we'll see what happens with the Warriors, and most likely they're going to win the championship. We'll see. We got a great panel this week. Three of the smartest people I know all together, all returning veterans of The Issue Is. One is Caroline Heldman. She's a professor at Occidental College. She's written a lot of books about presidential campaigns. She's a feminist. We see her out on the road often with Gloria Allred. Mike Murphy is here. He is now the co-director of the USC School for the Center for the Political Future. He's worked on campaigns advising Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, Arnold Schwarzenegger, John McCain, sort of moderate Republicans. He's not a big fan of President Trump. And Dan Schnur is with us as well, my former professor at USC. He's taught at UC Berkeley, also at Pepperdine, written a bunch of stuff. He ran for Secretary of State. He worked for John McCain, Pete Wilson. Bottom line, these guys are smart. They got lots to weigh in on, but let's begin with a conversation about abortion.
Welcome to you all. Good to have you all back here on The Issue Is. Let's start with the big issue of abortion this week, once again rearing its head. This is a topic that you've written so much about, Caroline. What do you make of what's happening right now, and how realistic a threat do you think it is to Roe v. Wade?
Well, it's a really good strategy for I call them the anti-choice folks, right, who are trying to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I should say, I was on the front lines of Operation Rescue. I was protesting outside of abortion clinics. clinics on the anti-choice side in the 70s and 80s. So this whole idea of working it, you know, didn't work at the federal level. Now let's work it at the state level, overturn abortion at the state level and get it back up to the Supreme Court. This is a plan 40 years in the making. I've had a front row seat to it. I'm on the other side of it now, and it's really clear to me that this is a strategy that will probably be effective for conservatives, but I think it will cost them electorally because only 17% of Americans want to overturn Roe v. Wade at this point in time.
What do you guys think?
Well, politically, it'll bring energy to the Democrats in the presidential year in most places, not all. I mean, this is an issue where everybody picks a side and starts yelling at each other. But the other issue involved is a constitutional one. Should states have a right to decide their own policy? Alabama's 60% pro-life. They elect pro-life politicians. They're trying to move a pro-life agenda. Out here, it's the opposite, as we saw with the governor's courageous remarks to be 1,000% where his voters are. The question for me is, does it get bumped up to the Supremes? Will they hear it? And will Roe v. Wade, which is a kind of tangled piece of constitutional law, the court twisted itself to kind of please what they perceived as public opinion in the 70s, will it get relitigated there, or will the court punt and not do it? That's the real power play going on behind the argument.
Alex, this is bad news for the Republican Party, and it's bad news for the pro-life movement. For many years now, pro-life advocates have been making incremental advances from 24 weeks to 20 weeks as advances in technology give prospective parents the opportunity to see a child or a fetus. They've been gradually moving forward. This is such a dramatic shift that if anything, it leads to a backlash, and you saw that from Gavin Newsom. The chair of the Republican National Committee was against this decision. Kevin McCarthy, the head of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, is against this decision. Reverend Pat Robertson thinks this is a bad decision. And Gavin Newsom, who is a very savvy politician and knows a good issue when he sees it, almost leapt right through the monitor to talk to you about what a bad thing this was. So it does, I think, to Mike's point, perhaps motivate the Republican base. But there are a lot of female voters out there who brought the Democrats the House back in 2018. This is an issue to motivate them even further in 2020.
And it is a voting issue that we've seen in the past, one of the few that does get people motivated on both sides.
The people Trump needs to get out of the 41% hole he's in are 3-1 pro-choice. So that's why the president has never been comfortable with abortion politics, because I think he's pro-choice as hell, personally. So whether or not the whole army's behind this move is going to be a big question.
It's a bad move. 1 in 4 women have abortions at some point during their life, right? So this is not just it's not just something that affects Democratic women. There are a lot of Republican women who might vote against this if it comes down to a vote.
And back in 1999, President Trump told Tim Russert, "I'm very pro-choice."
He's very flexible, I think we've learned.
Let's talk about the other issue that the Governor Newsom was talking about, which is his health care proposal. It would be a dramatic shift in this state. Mike, as a Republican, your response?
Well, I'm sympathetic to the idea of mandates. I worked with Mitt Romney when I was his consultant on that. The problem is, when I look at there are two parts of it. The politics of it is, all right, people who cannot afford health insurance, I'm going to fine you for that. That is a tough political equation, which is why this plan's in some trouble, even in the almost rubber-stamped Democratic legislature. The California Nurses Association are attacking it for the left because they're for single payer, which the governor pledged to them when he needed their vote he would do. I think systemically, not just here, the big problem in healthcare is cost. We have all these political fights about figuring out how to pay the bill. There's a lot of pandering involved. Everybody hates their insurance company because the insurance company are the gatekeepers who say no. So if we change the system and the incentives, pay doctors to cure people, not treat them, get the PBM managers who add 40% of the cost to your prescription. People beat up the drug companies. It's those middlemen who really do well. And start looking at systemic fixes on cost. This stuff where we're moving pieces around to find somebody for insurance they can't afford doesn't solve the big problem.
Dan, what do you make of the politics of the undocumented aspect of this, that he wants to give health care to people 26 and under?
Well, this is really interesting because the premise of your question, Alex, which I think was very smart, is aren't there voters who are going to be upset about seeing these resources devoted to young undocumenteds? The real push in Sacramento, though, is not from the right, as your question implied. It's from the left.
Right.
Newsom's biggest challenge is Democrats who don't just want to cover young people aged 26 and under who are undocumented, but they want to cover the entire undocumented population. And right now, we really haven't yet seen what happens when Gavin Newsom goes toe-to-toe and nose-to-nose with the legislature. They were scared of Jerry Brown. Jerry Brown was the grumpy old get-off-my-lawn governor, and they were scared
Clint
of him.
Eastwood.
They're still trying to figure Gavin out.
Right.
They pushed back at him this week on an important housing bill. They ignored him on a water tax that he wanted to raise. It's going to be interesting to see if the Democrats in the legislature are willing to go as slowly on this issue as Newsom want, or whether they're going to push him faster than he'd prefer.
Caroline, last word.
I would say that they're not going slowly on this issue, right? He is trying to get a waiver so that we can institute a single-payer system here in California. So he is attempting to give what the left wants. It's just a matter of getting there. And with a $21.5 billion surplus, he's in a really good position to pass legislation like this right now. So I do think that he's starting from a negotiating position and will certainly up getting this through the legislature, and it will cost less money because preventative care costs one-fifth what ER care costs, and everyone in California, whether you're documented or not, is going to the emergency room if you're sick or in crisis.
But he put his big push behind this, not single payer, and I agree with Dan. He should be watching Game of Thrones because he needs a dragon. Leaders have to have a little fear in the equation, and the legislature does not fear this governor.
Back now with our panel, Mike Murphy, Dan Schnur, Caroline Heldman. Dan, I'll start with you. Kamala Harris has the endorsement of almost everybody in California, yet polls show that she's not ahead in her home state. Why do you think that is?
Well, The Atlantic magazine ran a piece this week calling Kamala Harris the Jan Brady of the Democratic primary. And perhaps we should explain to some of your younger viewers who Jan Brady is and what magazines are. But just to be clear, she is in somewhat of a middle position. If you think about what has impressed her supporters most about her, where she's been her most forceful, has been in the Judiciary Committee, taking on Comey, taking on Sessions, taking on Kavanaugh. On the stump, she comes across as somewhat more cautious. And what she's going to have to figure out a way to do is to shift that persona that shows up on the Judiciary Committee onto the stump. Because right now where she is, as Jan, is she's progressive, but not quite as progressive as Sanders or Warren, and not quite as centrist as a Biden or a Buttigieg. At a certain point, being not quite as populist as Bernie Sanders is a pretty specific lane, and her next task is to figure out how to expand it.
To keep with that theme, Mike, who is Marsha, Marsha, Marsha?
Oh, I'm pop cultured out. I will say this about the presidential race. I've done a couple of them. And the hard lesson you learn is that the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, who are very important, are on their own schedule. They're not on the pundit schedule. This is too early to know anything. Those voters don't start to land till Thanksgiving, end of the year. So we're tasting a cake here before it's gone in the oven. I will say this. Ace Smith's a good friend of mine. I saw him the other day. When he wasn't looking, I stole Kamala's dream journal, and I saw her worst nightmare, which I think might come true, which is Cory Booker beats her in the Iowa caucus. Mm. He rolls into New Hampshire, and maybe second, and then he rolls into South Carolina, and he's the candidate after that huge block of Southern African-American voters, which has been the core of her strategy. We will have to see. The other advice I would give her is if you want to win the California primary, you better win New Hampshire. Because for all the talk about early voting, most of that vote is held. The biggest driver in California will be the momentum out of New Hampshire. The idea is she can lock up this state. It's too big. She's not strong enough. And endorsements, most people who make endorsements in politics, they can't deliver a pizza, let alone a vote. Mm. It is a waste of time. It's money and message and early state organization. She better focus on that.
Well, I think Kamala Harris is facing an uphill battle because she, first off, is a woman running for the presidency. And we know that there are severe barriers to that because we conceive of this position as being a highly masculine position. So even when two men are running, they tend to feminize one another because it's always a contest of masculinity. So where does that leave women, right? So they're damned if they do perform masculinity in order to be seen as presidential. And then they're damned if they don't because they're not seen as leadership potential, right, material. But then the moment moment at which they are properly masculine, they violate feminine norms. So it's an impossible scenario for women candidates. I think that this is why we see these incredibly strong candidates like Warren and Kamala Harris, who are behind Bernie, who are behind, way behind Biden. I also think there's a fear of electability, right? This idea that we need a white man at the top of the ticket in order to beat Trump. So all of this in the mix, in addition to her not really being much more than a centrist candidate.
Alex, can I pick up on the gender question for a second? Because I think what Caroline's talking about is fascinating. This will be the sixth consecutive presidential election since 2000 in which a woman has run for president. This is the first time that women have ever run against each other for president. And I think we've always fallen into the trap of figuring if Hillary Clinton behaves in a certain way, that's the way we react to female candidates. I think the real challenge here is for one to emerge. Elizabeth Warren right now is on the cover of Time magazine. There's that magazine thing again. There's Elizabeth Warren saying, I've got a plan for that. There's Kamala Harris saying, let's have a conversation about that. And is the more policy-driven, substantive approach or more of an outreach-driven approach preferable? But the fact that there's multiple female candidates is something I'd love to hear Caroline's thoughts on rather than just one.
Well, and Caroline's written a whole book on this topic. Yeah.
Yes, and so 12 women have run for the presidency seriously. Actually, 130 have put their name in the hat, but 12 have garnered national attention, a party label, and have gotten on the ballot in all 50 states. All of them face these same challenges. And this is an historic moment in that we have, as you noted, so many women running in the primary. It normalizes them as candidates, but still, 13% of the American population is angry or upset at the idea of a woman in the White House, and that is a larger gap than we've ever seen between a winning and losing presidential candidate.
And those are people that are just admit that, you know, to a pollster, too.
Correct.
So we're going to move on to another topic because we've got other people we want to talk about, too, including Beto O'Rourke and Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Beto O'Rourke seems to be, there was a whole article about how the media has already turned on him. Mayor Pete seems to be the darling of the media on the Tonight Show on The Issue Is. What do you make of the contrast between where these two guys are going?
Well, I think there's a market in the Democratic Party for new fresh. So this is the beginning of the beginning. And Beto's cold now. He just needs to jog across the street and rescue a puppy from a parking truck and he'll be hot again. Beto's a performer. You give him, the performers tend to endure well. So be careful, the media. They are always wrong. I remember President John Glenn and 100 others, particularly early. Election held tomorrow would be Biden because he's ahead. But there is no election tomorrow. There's a campaign, and that's what shapes these people. Mayor Pete is kind of the smart brother, and Beto's the tall, charming brother. And there's room, and they're going to be kind of wrestling all the way through. Pete is impressive. He's a very smart guy. I actually saw him in person give a speech not long ago. He does have the problem, which is fixable, of a speech that's all head and no heart. He's going to have to learn connecting better. But I'll give him this. Of all these candidates, he is the only one in the early, early preseason that has done something remarkable. He got himself out of double-A level baseball, where everybody was rolling their eyes at him, to the show. He's up there now. He's a player. So that talent, just like Beto's talent, is something you can watch go up and down every week and how the media casino's covering it. But long-term, they're both horses that can do some running. So, by the way, can Amy Klobuchar, who's being missed now, and so can Elizabeth Warren, who I think is the most underrated right now of the single-digit candidates.
Quick thoughts on this.
Amy Klobuchar, the strongest pro-Israel candidate in the race, I'll simply mention. But the Democratic primary, it seems to me, Alex, is a meta question to be decided. Bigger than health care, bigger than climate change. Biden, Booker, Buttigieg, they say Trump is an awful thing that happened. Let's fix it. Let's go back to normal. Warren, Sanders, maybe Harris come at it a different way. They say things were horrible before Donald Trump. We want something much more fundamental and much more transformational. The question for Democrats is, do they want to make things right and do a course adjustment or start from scratch? And the way they decide that question, I think, ultimately determines the nominee.
It'll be interesting to see President Obama's role in all of that, too. And one last note. Bill de Blasio got in the race this week. This is how his hometown paper covered it. De Blasio runs for president on the New York Post. They're literally laughing at him. Pictures of people laughing at him. But, Mike, you say,
well, look,
he's got a shot?
So here's the deal. The New York, you know, if New Yorkers draw a map of the world, there'd be New York City and some blurry stuff out the distance. There's no early New York primary. And so I just see them piling up on him. He's like a beaten down stock. I see the problems too, but watch his announcement video. It's on Twitter. I think the Democratic electorate, and there's some polling about this, is looking for kind of three different interlocking piles. Identity, which means either non-white or woman, progressive economics, tax the rich, kill the corporations, and a fighter to take on Trump. He's all three. And for all the laughing, I'm old enough to remember the New York City mayor's race, and everybody was laughing about him too. And he came out of nowhere to crush everybody. And he's done it twice, so the second race was not competitive. So even though they hate him back home, and I don't like him, I spent a lot of time in New York, what he's selling in a Democratic primary and ultra-low expectations, he might have a moment or two. I'm not going to bet he'll get nominated, but he's watch that video and tell me that he won't sell a few tickets.
Caroline, Dan, just you, yes or no, do you think Bill de Blasio could be the Democratic nominee?
Yes.
Anybody can. There's 24 of them.
All right,
look out for Kardashian. There's still more to come.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Our thanks to our panel. Now it's time to talk to one of the 23, 24 Democratic presidential candidates, Democrat Tulsi Gabbard, Congresswoman from Hawaii, in town this week. Got a chance to talk to her exclusively one-on-one about how she sees the world, which is different than the way many of her Democratic colleagues see the world, especially on the issues of foreign policy. Here's my report from Santa Monica.
Oh, it's all of us.
Tulsi Gabbard greets supporters in Santa Monica. The Hawaii Congresswoman is given a lei and a standing ovation from local Democrats. The soldier in the Army National Guard is running on a non-interventionist foreign policy. We spoke in an exclusive interview.
I will end these wasteful regime change wars, work to end this new Cold War and nuclear arms race.
She says she'd pull all troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and not send any to places like Venezuela.
Since 9/11 alone, we've seen anywhere from $6 to $8 trillion going to pay for these wasteful regime change wars.
Joining the National Guard after 9/11.
Gabbard says ending these wars will allow her to pay for things like universal health care and tuition-free college.
What happens if we all of a sudden leave? Are you worried that Russia or China or Iran or some of these other countries might fill that power vacuum?
You know, it's an unfortunate argument that often dismisses the fact that it is our regime change wars in these countries, like Iraq, Libya, Syria, our ongoing war in Afghanistan, that have undermined our national security, have made us less safe by strengthening terrorist groups like ISIS.
If elected, Gabbard, a surf enthusiast, would make history in a variety of ways. At 38, she'd be the first millennial president, the first woman president, the first Hindu president, and the first Iraq war veteran to be president.
There's no question that having these experiences of deploying twice to the Middle East, of seeing firsthand not only the high cost of war, but also the importance of our national security. These things are not only motivating me to run for president, but they are what makes me qualified to be able to walk in on day one and actually do that job of commander-in-chief.
In a crowded field, Gabbard has struggled to gain traction in early polls, but she's clearly beloved by a loyal base.
How are you going to win this thing?
Well, the polls, I think, are jumping all over the place. There's a lot of folks who are running. But as you're seeing here this evening, there's a lot of grassroots support as we continue to grow and build our campaign and to take our message directly to voters. The experience that I bring to this candidacy, to this campaign, is something that unique, that stands apart from the other people who are running for president. And the message that my campaign is delivering to the American people is unique.
And you can watch the full interview with Congresswoman Gabbard online by going to youtube.com/AlexMichelson. A final note, this week we lost a great American comedian. We're enlisting the help of Carol Burnett for this tribute. Tim Conway was a comic genius that famously led his fellow players to crack up alongside him on The Carol Burnett Show and other iconic broadcasts. His son, Tim Jr., is one of our all-time favorite panelists. Both father and son have brought us so much joy, and as we say farewell, we're sending both of them a whole lot of love.
There's a time you put aside for dreaming, and a time for things you have to do.
Gotta love the Conways. That's it for our Issue Is podcast. We encourage you to listen to a podcast extra this week. Mike Murphy is with us, sat down to tell a lot of stories about His past campaigns, analyzed the current campaign. It's funny, it's interesting, it's different. I encourage you to check it out and to watch us on TV as well. Friday nights on Fox 11 Los Angeles at 10:30, Saturday mornings KTVU in the Bay Area at 6:30 a.m. And also on youtube.com/AlexMichelson, where you can also see more from Tulsi Gabbard. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you next time for more of The Issue Is. We'll be right back.